This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. A lot of interesting news out there. Most of it seems, the good stuff anyway, seems to be coming out of the Democratic Party and the Democrats. The Democrats had suggested that there be a five-year freeze on subprime mortgages blowing up in people's faces, adjustable rate mortgages, balloon payments, interest-only mortgages, things like this. And George Bush now coming out and saying, yeah, we're going to do something like that, as if it was his idea. On the other hand, the American people, and frankly, Bush, I mean, Bush was out here going, oh, we're addicted to oil. The American people are very concerned about the fact that every time you fill up your car, you know, if you're driving the old, what's the old bumper sticker? If you're driving alone, you're driving with Osama. Every time you fill up your car, a portion of that money is going to go to Saudi Arabia, who's going to give a portion of that money to the Wahhabist madrasas who are going to teach that, you know, the Osama bin Laden line, our dependence on Middle Eastern oil is not only a geopolitical problem and an economic problem, but it's also a security problem in a very real way. And so the Democrats in Congress decided to do something about it, actually did something about it. Jay Inslee is with us. He represents Washington State's 1st District. And he's on the line. Congressman Jay Inslee, welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Thanks for your interest in this.
Yeah, this is a big deal. The energy bill here that give us the thumbnail sketch of this thing.
Well, basically, it's, you know, you started the show, your intro is, you stand for, I think it's truth, freedom, and the American way, and this is freedom. This is attempting to have freedom from Middle Eastern oil because we know the security concerns of funding the regions in the Mideast. And we'd rather, you know, frankly, spend our money and get our fuel from Middle Western farmers rather than Middle Eastern sheiks. So that's freedom. And the American way part of it is that our way of solving problems is to use our heads and innovate and do technological solutions. We're the world's most technologically advanced country. And we believe, we Democrats believe, and I hope a few Republicans, that we are just as smart, just as confident as when Kennedy said we should go to the moon in 10 years. And that's why we think we need a project that's similar in scope and ambition as the original Apollo project. And this bill today is going to do some very, very strong things. First, it's going to, for the first time in 30 years, improve our auto efficiency standards. This is long, long overdue. And we know that we can wean ourselves off of foreign oil if we, in fact, insist that the manufacturers provide us with efficient cars. This will raise the standards from 25 to 35 miles per gallon. Second, the bill will provide that 15% of our electricity by 2020 will come from a combination of clean, renewable sources, wind, solar photovoltaic, enhanced geothermal, wave power, and efficiency, where we can conserve energy and not waste it. This is a very important piece to drive investment into these new technologies that are not fossil fuel based. Third, we're going to have a whole slew of guarantees to Americans that the equipment that we use is going to be up to snuff technologically. So we have standards that will reduce the energy used in our lighting by 70%, standards that will make our heating and cooling equipment much more effective to save energy. Fourth, we have some requirements that will move forward in our buildings and our building codes, because that's where 30-40% of our energy is used, and consequently our CO2 is coming. So we're going to make our homes and businesses and help people make sure their homes are up to snuff to not waste energy. There's new reports saying that we can reduce our energy usage 50% over the next decade and a half compared to what we otherwise would use, just by doing common sense things like using energy efficient lighting, having insulation in your homes. And this is going to help homeowners in that regard. And fifth, it's going to pay for this. And this is really important. You know, we Democrats, we've had it with, you know,
borrow and spend
everything
politics.
On the credit card, putting everything on our kids' credit card, right?
Yeah.
So we're paying for it. And the way we're paying for this is we are reeling back in about $13 billion of tax breaks that were given to the oil and gas industries long ago that there's no reason on this green earth that taxpayers should be subsidizing big oil right now. I mean, they're charging $3 a gallon. They're the most profitable corporations in the history of the solar system.
I think ExxonMobil is now the largest corporation.
Certainly,
the
and there's no reason that you should be paying taxes on April 15th and giving it to, you know, these oil companies. So we're reeling that back in, and we're using those funds to help small businessmen and women, homeowners, people who are buying cars to get fuel-efficient equipment, housing, and appliances, and also help to motivate, frankly, to give some help to these emerging businesses who are building these new technologies all across the country. So this is a winning proposition any way you slice it. And I think today is, well, maybe not quite as romantic, but the same impact as May 25th, 1961, when Kennedy said, he stood in the House, and I'm sitting around in the cloakroom right off the House floor right now, I just spoke on the bill. He said we're going to go to the moon in 10 years, and we did it because he knew Americans can produce when we're challenged. And that same can-do spirit exists in this country today, and we're seeing this all across the country. In Florida, with the Austria Solar Thermal Company just signed a contract for 300,000 homes to produce with solar thermal power. The Imperium Biodiesel Company in Grays Harbor, Washington's former dying timber town, now it's the largest biodiesel plant in the world, 100 million gallons of clean biodiesel, which, as you know, reduces CO2 emissions dramatically. The Alta Rock Company, which is developing a way to do enhanced geothermal, we have massive amounts of geothermal energy below our feet, assuming we can perfect this technology to put water down there and extract the energy. So we're seeing all this technological boom, and the reason I know about it is I just got done writing a book about it called Apollo's Fire, and I just met these people all over the country who are doing great work.
Yeah, we're talking with Congressman Jay Inslee, his website, house.gov/Inslee, I-N-S-L-E-E, the author of Apollo's Fire, about this new House energy bill. Congressman, here's the one fly in the ointment. Here you have this great piece of legislation, the writer's summary of it. It repeals Section 199 tax deduction for major oil companies generating $10 billion over 10 years, drops Section 907 foreign income tax deductions, raising $3.19 billion over 10 years. It ends the tax break for companies to write off exploration expenses. It raises $4.1 billion. Extends tax credits to produce energy for renewable sources like wind, biomass, geothermal, landfill gas, trash burning. This is $6 billion in costs over 10 years. Extends 30% investment tax credits for businesses to install solar fuel cells. 10% tax credit to install microturbines through the end of 2016. Tax credits for home energy. I mean, raise the tax cap up to $4,000. This is a lot of really, and that's just the beginning of it, a lot of really great stuff. And about an hour ago, the White House announced that they're going to veto it.
Well, you know, it's not.
That's the difference between now and Jack Kennedy.
There is a little difference between President Kennedy and the current occupant of the White House. And the difference is that the current president, simply does not understand the creative power of the United States citizens.
Oh, I think he understands it perfectly well, but he's an old oil guy. His vice president is an old oil guy.
We need to break those shackles that he is continuing to enslave the American people. This is about freedom. It's the freedom to be able to pull up to a pump, and you decide whether you're going to use cellulosic ethanol or biodiesel or electricity, because we're talking about the electrification of the car now, which is very imminent to have plug-in hybrids that go 40 miles with zero CO2. Those cars are on the road today, and GM's bringing another one. He simply does not understand how the federal government can help the emergence of these new technologies. And to subsidize an industry that was mature 100 years ago makes no sense. And it's only happened because the oil and gas industry has had its tentacles around this institution for far too long, and we're breaking those today.
So are you going to be able to get a large enough vote in the House to be able to overcome a veto, and do you think that the same thing will happen in the Senate or not?
We don't know the answer to that. At the time, that just remains to be seen. I will tell you this. What I have learned about this issue, I have never seen an issue advance as rapidly as this one had. A year ago, I wouldn't have given you a dollar's chance that we would have advanced as far as we have. And the reason for this is that the American people now are seeing both the science of global warming. They've seen 1 million miles of the Arctic square miles melt this summer, the size of six Californias. They've seen the science make this abundantly clear, and they're demanding action on global warming. At the same time, they're seeing these technologies come on, like wind right now, which has the capacity to do 20% of our electricity in the next 25 years, they're seeing this development. So the science is maturing. And frankly, we're really lucky this is the case, because if we didn't have these technologies, we'd be really behind the eight ball with global warming. So the country is seeing it. Now we need the Congress to see it, and if we have to get to two-thirds, so be it. This needs to become law, and it's going to be a big day for the country.
Yep, and what our listeners can do is go to callcongress.org. There's a list of toll-free numbers that you can use to get to the switchboard on Capitol Hill. If you're not sure who your member of the House of Representatives is, just give them your zip code. They'll connect you with your representative and say, hey, please support that energy legislation that's going through Congress right now. Congressman Jay Inslee, house.gov/Inslee, thank you.
Thanks for this. Let's go get
it. The Tom Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
We gotta get out of this place. If it's the last thing we ever do, we gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you.
21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my. So we need to help get this energy bill passed, and we need to get it with a supermajority, enough people that it cannot be vetoed or that the veto can be overridden. Step one. Mitt Romney gave his speech on religion today. It wasn't at all the Kennedy speech. Kennedy came out and said quite clearly, he actually named issues like birth control and things like that and said family planning and said, you know, if these issues come before me as president, even though I'm a Catholic, I'm going to represent the American people. And he took positions opposite that of his church. Mitt Romney, on the other hand, says that, you know, when he takes an oath to uphold the Constitution, that's his promise to God. I thought it was his promise to us. Color me confused, but Mitt Romney trying to suck up to the same conservative Christian voters that Mike Huckabee is getting, and I guess this is his attempt to get it back. Today and tomorrow, I'm filling in on the morning show on KPOJ, doing the old gig I used to do for the last couple of years, filling in for Carl Wolfson, who is on his way to Minneapolis, where hopefully he'll bring us back some photos of the Larry Craig Memorial restroom. And in any case, so I had to get up at 3 o'clock this morning to come in and do a radio show at 6. And so last night at 7-something, 7:30, whatever, I'm in bed asleep, and the phone rings. And it's this company that has been calling for a couple of weeks now, 2-3 times, 4 times a day, and Scarborough Research, I think it's called. And I didn't, you know, most of the time we ignore it. Louise has asked them a couple of times not to call. They keep calling. But I didn't have my glasses on. I couldn't see what it was on the caller ID, so I just answered the phone, and the guy was like, we'd just like to ask you a few questions. And I said, please put me on your do not call list. And he said, we don't have a do not call list. We're not, you know, apparently they're not selling a product, so they're not covered by that legislation. And I said, please don't call me anymore. And he said, well, I can't say that we won't call you anymore. And he says, and if you'll just answer my questions, it'll just take a couple of minutes. And at that point, I hung up on him. And then I went on the web and I tracked down the phone number of the company and I called up and I got their voicemail and I said, I'm declaring war on you guys, which probably was a stupid thing to say. I'm probably going to have the FBI on my doorstep. But Tom Mabe has I've been trying to figure out what should I have done when this telemarketing company called. And Tom Mabe at TomMabe, MABE.com. This is a guy who showed up at the telemarketing convention in Washington, D.C., where all the telemarketing bigwigs get there, you know, to get press, positive press for telemarketers and lobby against laws that might prohibit telemarketing. He checks into the same hotel with these guys, finds out what floors they're on, what rooms they're in, and at 3 a.m. starts calling to sell them sleeping pills. This is incredible. Here is a phone call. I'll play a little bit of it right now. We'll take a break. I'll play a little bit more. From Tom Mabe's album. He actually sells albums over at his website, TomMabe.com. He does this kind of stuff for a living. This is a real phone call.
Yes, can I speak with Tom Mabe?
He's calling.
Well, this is Mike Stewart with Network. You've been selected to receive a complete digital satellite system for free. With this, you're going to...
Let me ask you something. Did you know Tom Mabe? Were you a friend of his?
No, I'm not. I'm just calling to...
Hold on one second. All right. Hey, guys, get really good pictures of the body.
See, this is what I need to be doing the next time you call. Get good pictures of the body, guys.
Yeah, and dust everything down for Prince. Mike, you there?
Yeah. Let me bring you up to speed. You've actually called a murder scene. Mr. Mabe is no longer with us. I'm Officer Clark. I'm conducting a homicide investigation. I want to ask you a series of questions. First of all, what was the nature of the business you had with Tom Mabe?
This, you turned around on a guy.
I had no business with him. I'm sorry to bother
you. No, hold on. Look, I want to ask you to stay on the phone. This call's already been traced, and we may need you to come in for further questioning.
You don't understand. I'm just calling on...
No, look.
I'm just a telemarketer. It's like, how long can you keep him on the phone?
You don't understand. I just want to be charged with obstruction of justice. It's imperative you keep your ass on the phone, Mike.
Well, how about you just talk with my supervisor then?
No. Look, we'll get your supervisor in a second. First of all, give me your whereabouts.
I'm at work.
You're at work?
Yes.
You being a smart?
No, sir.
But let me put it to you this way, Mike. Say I want to mail your letter. What would I have to write on the outside of that envelope to ensure the mailman would deliver it right to your ass? Geographically speaking, Mike, where is work?
4715 West Street.
Now, hold on. That's 478.
Yes, sir.
Michael, hold on one second, all right?
Yes.
Did you? Get the Louisville Police Department Homicide Division on the phone. Yeah, give him this information. They can tell him he's being sought in connection with a fatal shooting and aggravated robbery.
So now he's got this telemarketer thinking that his own local police department is being called, and they're going to show up at his house. And this is where it just... begins to get weird, Tom Mabe. And so, you know, what are your stories? What have you done when telemarketers or, like in my case with Scarborough Research, companies that are doing surveys just call you over and over and over? And in my case last night, wake you up. How do you deal with it? Obviously, I dealt with it rather poorly last night. This guy's a great role model. And frankly, what should we all be doing about it? 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Pull over to the shoulder.
Yeah, that's what they said last night when they woke me up. this company, Scarborough Research, and it's interesting. I went online, I Googled the phone number that showed up in my caller ID that was 941-379-1954, and one of the first things that came up was 800notes.com, and there's all these people. Richard says, they're all being called by the same number I'm being called by, and I've got an unlisted number. In fact, I've changed my number 3 times in the last 2 years. That's how unlisted our number is, because every now and then, you know, it gets out there, and then the death threats and the crank calls start. Anyhow, he says, I did not answer. The calls keep coming for weeks now. Last night it was even later. Virginia resident says, calls between 5 and 6 p.m. every night, Monday through Friday. Sundays, they start calling at 9 p.m., followed by at least one call every 30 minutes until 11. We have now been forced to turn off our landline at 9 p.m. on Sundays, telling family and friends to contact us via cell. We are on the do not call list, yet they still call. Donna says, I am on the do not call list, and yet they still call. They've been calling for weeks, at least once per day, sometimes even after I've gone to bed. It's very, very annoying. A couple of times they even left voicemails assuring me that they're not selling anything, but that shouldn't matter. I don't want to be harassed. Another one says, called their own number back to remove my name from the list, said they don't do that. Received a note in the mail saying they'd like to call me again for survey responses. Called resumed every couple of days at all hours, been going on for months. It's been going on with us for about 2 weeks that we've been getting calls 3, 4, 5 times a day from this company. And as I said, last night I talked to the guy and I said, put me on the do not call list. He says, no, we don't do that. Sorry, we're going to keep calling you. And, you know, this could get serious. For example, a pedestrian yesterday in San Leandro was struck and killed by an Amtrak train. Why? Because as he was walking across the tracks, he was talking on his cell phone. What if it was a call from one of these companies? So anyhow, Tom Mabes over at TomMabes.com, he's got this, he gets a call from a telemarketer. He's doing it right. I did it wrong. I called him up and I said, I'm going to declare war on you guys. I'm really pissed. And that, you know, that's just the wrong way to do it. You got to figure out how to, So he's got this telemarketer convinced that he's called when he called that the guy that he was trying to call is dead, and he's talking to a police detective, and the police detective says, gets his name and phone number, his address, and says, okay, we're going to track you down, and to the telemarketer.
How did you know Mr. Mabe again?
Wait, you're calling the Littleton Police Department? I'm hundreds of miles away.
You're calling my police department? I'm just a telemarketer.
I don't even know the guy. I'm in Colorado.
Don't let that scare you. That's just a formality. Have you ever been to his place of residence?
No.
Right, tell me again, where were you last night between the hours of 8 and 10?
I'm not feeling real comfortable about any of this.
Have you even ever spoken with Mr. Mabe, Mike?
No, I haven't. I don't even know the guy. That's what I've been trying to tell you.
Okay, just calm down. Calm down. Hold on. Look, just back up. I got one more question for you, Mike. As you well know, I'm sure, Mr. Mabe was a flaming homosexual. And there's no easy way of asking that. I don't want to embarrass you or nothing, but were you his gay lover?
What? No. What the hell kind of a question?
Look. If gay's your way, that's okay. I still know there's a lot of you gay people in the closet. I'm not saying I haven't thought about myself. You know? Say I was in Las Vegas or something. A couple drinks. Cute little Mexican midget.
This is ridiculous.
He's got this poor telemarketing guy just totally going. TomMabes.com. It's brilliant. 1-866-303-2270. What do you do? Hey, we can talk about politics, too. I mean, as I said, there's the important political thing right now, I think, is to call Congress and tell them no on Senate Bill 1959 and yes on the energy bill. We need to get that through. Jackie in Akron, Ohio. Hey, Jackie, welcome to the program.
Well, I've been having great fun with telemarketers for several years now, just doing exactly what Tom Mabes did. Just no matter what they're selling, you need it bad. I even had the police called on me once, but it was so worth it. I play with them, and it's so much more fun than hanging up and getting mad. This woman was calling me to sell me a burial plot, and I told her instantly that, oh, my God, I just got back from the doctor. I have a brain tumor, and I can't live with this. And I let her believe I was going to commit suicide. And she was so beside herself that the police came to my door, and the policeman laughed his butt off. It was hysterical. But then another time I was called. I've done it constantly. No matter what it is, I need it. Carpet cleaners called, and I asked if they could remove blood. And I said, oh, thank God, because there's blood all over this place. Can you clean the furniture? I was called because I want a diamond ring, and I was so excited. I wouldn't let them talk. And they always end up hanging up on me. And
great.
It's just no matter what they're selling, you need it, and then just go off on a crazy rant, and they will hang up on you, and it's so much more satisfying.
It's like you're trying to keep them on the line as long as you can.
Oh, absolutely. And just have fun. It's a blast.
That is great. Jackie, thank you so much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Patty in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Patty.
Hi there. I'm having fun listening to this. The solution our family came up with was my 15-year-old and my 11-year-old have their own cell phones. That number is only given out to friends. They can't get it anywhere else. And we removed our landline. We have phone, which I have on mute and vibrate, whatever, so we can screen calls. So the control is back into our family, so we don't even have to answer them. However, in defense of some of these people that are holding down these terrible jobs, telemarketing,
yeah.
I think if we just don't answer the phone, they can go home at the end of their day with their lousy paychecks. I telemarketed in New York City for New York City Ballet and in L.A. for the Los Angeles Theater Center. And you get some good calls, you get some bad calls.
I absolutely understand. When I was 15 years old, it might have been when I was 16, but it was right around that. It was last year of high school, and I actually had a job for about a week and a half. That's how bad I was at it. In Lansing, Michigan, for a company, I was selling light bulbs and ladies' nylons over the telephone. And telemarketing people, yeah. And I did, I've been there, and I know that they're, and there's a lot of people who, they desperately need a job. And I've tried, being nice to these, but this particular company, after we've asked them not to call us repeatedly, continues to call 3-4 times a day. and has been for a couple of weeks, the Scarborough Research Company.
And then it's the Better Business Bureau, and just don't answer the phone.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, I'm like, okay, I'm yeah, you're doing a job, but you're not going to do a job on me. Patty, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. It's great to hear from you. Sam in Tampa. Hey, Sam.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. What's up?
I take the have fun with it route as well. I just kind of gave up a long time ago. So what I do is I either act like Beavis and Butthead. I usually sound like Butthead more often. Just kind of have fun talking circles, just have the ask all kinds of stupid questions and stuff.
For example, okay, Sam, I'm calling. Hi, Sam. I'm Tom with Scarborough Research, and we just want to ask you a few questions.
Hello? Can you, get off the phone or something?
No. I have a couple of questions I need to. It's only going to take 2 minutes.
I don't know. I can't do it right now.
You can't role play? Okay, all righty. Well, it was a good try. I got to get somebody to role play this with me. I appreciate it. Sam, thanks a lot for the call. Jesse in Oakland, California. Hey, Jesse.
Hey there, Tom. What's going on?
Well, it's obviously we're going to get back to politics. We're going to have a lot of it all day today. This is a real life issue that affects everybody. I'm just curious, what do you do with telemarketers?
You know, I have three strategies, and they all work pretty well depending on my mood.
Okay, and they are?
The first one is, I just talk to them, and I refuse to talk to them about anything except the thing I want to talk about.
Okay.
So, for instance, I like to talk about Elvis.
Uh-huh.
So I make it my goal for me to make them talk about Elvis.
Okay.
And I refuse to talk to them about anything but Elvis, and no matter what they say, I bring it around back to Elvis.
That's great.
And you know, first thing is, almost anybody likes to talk about Elvis.
Sure.
Second of all, you get to learn, people do all kinds of, ridiculous things to try to not talk about the stuff that they're supposed to be talking about, or maybe they want to talk about Elvis, but they're afraid their boss is listening or whatever.
Right.
So I do that. Now, it doesn't have to be Elvis. I find Elvis works really well because I like to talk about Elvis.
Sure.
But I also talk to them about what we ought to do to end this war in Iraq and how we ought to impeach Bush. And I refuse to talk to them about anything but that.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they and I I'm really genial about it. And basically, they either engage with me about that or they get off the phone quick.
Huh.
I think the worst case scenario is, I'm going to talk about something I want to talk about. That's the worst case scenario.
That's a strategy, Jesse. That's a really good strategy. Thanks for sharing that with us. Sean in Queens, New York. Hey, Sean.
Hey, I've actually worked on, have two different strategies. One, usually only for credit cards.
Mm-hmm.
Have a really crazy religious belief and say they go through their spiel oh, we've got a credit card, introduction rate, yada, yada, yada. Wait a second, let me interrupt you there. Can you use it on Tuesdays? Well, sure. And they go back into their pitch about reward points. Can you use the credit card to purchase Wizards? Well, you can, if it's a MasterCard store, you can use it. It's great. They go back and so you can use your credit cards to buy Wizards on Tuesdays? Well, yes, of course. Well, that's against my religion. I'm sorry. I can't talk to you.
You can get really weird. Can I use this credit card to buy assault weapons that I might take into? Actually, this is a bad day to talk about that, I suppose.
It's a Nebraska thing.
Yeah. But you could use it to get really weird. Oh my, Sean, we're getting a lot of great ideas here. I do appreciate it. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you, running on 3 hours sleep. We'll be right back.
Radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, I didn't exactly take the high road last night, I'll tell you. It's, I mean, after they woke me up, because I had to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning here to come in and fill in for the morning show on KPOJ. And after I get off the air, I got to drive all the way down to Salem, the state capital. I'm doing a book signing this afternoon at 2 o'clock at the Willamette store. And I'm not complaining about that. I'm looking forward to it, actually. Give a speech and sign books and stuff. And I'm going to get back late. And then tomorrow morning, I've got to get up at 3 again. And so when this guy wakes me up, and then I say, you know, the Scarborough research guy and wakes me up, who's been calling for weeks, 2, 3, 4 times a day. And I say, put me on your do not call list. He says, no, we don't do that. And please stop calling me. We'll continue to call if we want. And not only was I wide awake by that point, but for the next hour, I couldn't get back to sleep because I'm laying there having fantasies about how I'm going to offer $1,000 ransom or a reward for the home phone number of Mr. Cohen, the CEO of the company, so that I can start calling him up with interviews at 3 a.m. And, you know, I realized this morning that was just, you know, I was just stupid. And I called their company headquarters and I said, I'm so angry. I'm declaring war on you guys. I'm going to, you know, and which it probably causes them to think that I'm, you know, some kind of whack job. Well, here's my war. I'm going to figure out how best to deal with these guys. So, John in Portland, how do you deal with them?
I like to just kind of start a thing in the house with seeing with how long you can keep them on hold. Yeah, you know, I just need to get my wife on the line. Let me, you know, she makes all those decisions. She spends all that big money all the time. Here she is. And then see how long you can get them to wait, and then just eventually you'll hear the phone. It may be, you know, you might be finishing, you know,
I'm going to go wash the dishes. Yeah, exactly. That's a great strategy. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it. Tim in Los Angeles, what do you do?
You know what I usually do, because I get, like, telemarketers every once in a while. What I would do is one of two things. The first one I would do is pretending that I'm deaf or hard of hearing. Mm-hmm. So when they start asking questions, I'll say, like, can you repeat that again? Or if they ask me a question, I'll answer back in a question that's incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
So if you ask me something like, would you like to buy da-da-da? Like, would you like to buy some tennis shoes? And I'd say, you want me to buy some Jews? What's that?
Yeah, right. If they're calling, I mean, this is a survey company. If they're saying, well, what do you think about Hillary Clinton? I'd say, I really like that Dennis Kucinich guy, or maybe John Edwards. No, we're asking about Hillary Clinton. Exactly.
And the second one is, since you work at a radio station, I know that you guys have, like, a lot of sound drops. Mm-hmm. Use some of the sound effects you have. For example, like, another thing that I did, what I do is, I tell them that I'm in the toilet right now, and I'm Asian, and I'm kind of sick. So then, when they start asking questions,
start making gross noises.
I play sound effects, and then I say, "Oh, can you repeat that question again?" It was kind of a blah 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 blah.
And there's a loud in the background or something like that. Yeah, Tim, thanks a lot. That's Billy in San Francisco. Hey, Billy.
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Just great. What do you do here?
What I do, and this only works for guys, but it's effective in about 10 seconds to get rid of these bozos. I ask them what kind of underwear they're wearing, and then I start making really disgusting noises and take it downhill from there.
Okay. That's another one. I appreciate it. Thank you, Billy. Joan in Seattle. Hey, Joan.
I'm fine, Tom. Love your show. But I have no problem with telemarketers, and I used to. And what I tell them is that I don't talk to people for free, that they're going to have to pay me at least what I earn in my work, or I'm not wasting my time. And so I say I'd get $20 an hour, and if you want to talk to me, I'll be happy to do it. But I want to, you know, I want $20 an hour, and I want to talk to someone that will agree to that.
And please give me your Visa or MasterCard number
exactly,
right now.
Yeah.
I can charge it.
Because I say, hey, my time is valuable, too. Do you work for free? Yeah.
There you
go. And, boy, I just get very few. I can't remember the last time I got a call.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Joan. I appreciate it. Pete in Bronx, New York. Hey, Pete.
Hey, usually, how you doing, Tom? By the way, you are the best.
Thank you.
Usually,
I'm also punch drunk tired, as you can probably tell.
It has happened to us so many times, and I found The best thing is actually an old Seinfeld routine. I start asking them personal questions. So it would go like, you be the guy, call me.
Okay. Hey, Pete, this is Tom with Scarborough Research, and I'm calling to ask you some questions. It's just going to take 2 minutes.
Great. What did you say your name was?
Tom.
Where are you calling from right now?
Well, I've got some questions for you, but
no, but I mean the address of where you are.
I'm in Portland, Oregon.
But
I've got these questions about the political campaign.
Do you live in Portland, Tom?
Yeah, but I really would like to ask you about the campaign if you don't mind.
Not a problem. Hey, if we get cut off, what's your number? What's your
Well, it's on your caller ID. You can call me back,
I don't have that. Do you have a personal phone?
Yeah, we don't give out personal. I want to ask you about the. Oh, this is good, Pete. This is good.
So
good.
I just try to connect with them personally, and they freak out.
That's great. Yeah. Pete, thanks so much for that. Okay. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Norm in Hollywood, California. Hey, Norm.
This isn't for telephone people, but for the religious people that come to the doors quite often and want to try to tell you different things, mm-hmm. just answer the door naked. Invite him in. Hey guys, how's it doing?
That's the real life equivalent of the guy who said that he says he's on the toilet and then starts making loud noises and says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question."
Everywhere I've ever lived, I've done it once and they've never come back again.
I can imagine. Thank you, Norm. Oh man, Ed in Portland. Hey Ed.
Hey, how's it going, Tom? One thing I wanted to mention real quick is that the matrix that these callers live and die by is their average handle time. So really, anything you do that extends the amount of time that they're on the phone really messes them up.
Yeah, so that's just waste their time forever. That's a good point. Ed, thanks a lot. Coming up next, we're going to debate with Alex Epstein of the Ayn Rand Institute about predatory lending. He thinks it's a good thing. I kind of disagree. Stick around.
The Tom Hartman Program for your minimum daily adult requirements of sanity. Tom Hartman. You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Speaking of, obnoxious, what happens when you amp that up to predatory? How do we as a society, or we as individuals, protect ourselves from the sociopaths among us? How do we protect ourselves from the predators among us? How do we protect ourselves from those who would manipulate us or lie to us? Or simply use the fact that we're not all experts on everything, and most of us certainly are not experts on the language, for example, the arcane language of a 20-page mortgage document, to navigate our way safely through the world of getting a mortgage. Alex Epstein is on the line. He's the junior fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, Alex Epstein, ayn rand.org, AYNRAND.org, the holders of the flame of objectivism. Ayn Rand, the author of Atlas Shrugged and other other articles on objectivism that have become the basis for objectivism, which has in turn informed libertarianism and has in turn informed much of the modern conservative movement. Alex, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back. Predatory lending legislation. We used to have regulation. First of all, back before Bush Sr. came into office, we had regulated the savings and loan industry. He lifted the regulations on Reagan lifted the regulations on the savings and loan industry. And what happened? The predators came in, made off with $500 billion, and we had to bail it out with our tax dollars, including Jeb Bush's brother Neil. Over the next 10 years, and I'm not sure exactly when it happened, but a relatively gradual process in pieces, Bill Clinton played a significant role in it. The banks got deregulated, and actually it was Bill Clinton who signed the legislation that did away with the Glass-Steagall Act, which made it illegal for banks to own securities. And so now we got banks who are holding these mortgage assembled securities, and they're running out of money. We could see a run on the banks. We have in some cases. I mean, this is a potential disaster. What is your take on how it should be handled?
Okay, well, first of all, I think there are a couple of factual errors there, but the one I most want to correct is the idea that the savings and loan crisis was caused by deregulation toward the end of the Reagan administration or by the first Bush administration. That, I mean, that's a whole long story that we could devote a whole show to, but that thing was decades in the making, and the whole government-created structure of savings and loan and savings and loan deposit insurance, that's what created that whole fiasco. Not that Reagan or Bush responded properly to it. They messed it up even more. Now, as far as the current thing, I think there are a couple of different causes, and they all come down to various forms of government intervention in the market. And so let's take the banks that have mortgage-backed securities and that, by all indications, did not exercise sufficient due diligence in terms of seeing whether the loans that they were securitizing were good loans, and thus they have a lot of liabilities that they didn't expect to have. Well, one reason that kind of thing is permitted to happen is because throughout the economy, we've got the implicit idea, and sometimes explicit, that any big financial institution, any big bank, is, quote, too big to fail. And we've seen this throughout history. In 1984, there was a bank called Continental in Illinois that they explicitly said, it's too big to fail, we have to bail it out. They bailed out all the savings and loans. There was deposit insurance. But someone like...
No, I know. It's an old joke in business, particularly among small businessmen, that, you know, if you owe your bank $10,000 and you can't repay it, you've got a problem. If you owe your bank $10 million and you can't repay it, your bank has a problem. But, and I don't disagree with your assertion that the banks who are holding these securities and state governments and whatnot. I mean, here in Oregon, actually, back some years ago, the Secretary of State's office looked at these mortgage-backed securities and said, no, this state will not invest in them. And there are some states, there are some governments. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal a couple days ago about a town in northern Norway that bought these investments. And now the town can't keep their streetlights on because they're going broke. We didn't do it in this state. I think that was wise. But what about the individual? What about the family who comes in and they say, oh yeah, you can get this mortgage, no problem. We'll get you into this mortgage, and it really is not the appropriate thing for them. They don't realize what the consequences of that 5-year ARM will be, or they don't realize that because of these new laws, if they're one payment late on their car, then suddenly their interest rates get jacked up on their mortgage, on their credit cards, on everything in sight. You know, you really think that if we just left all this to the so-called free market, in other words, basically to the corporations who are running the game, that it's not going to screw the consumer?
Well, we've left most of it to the government and, quote-unquote, screwed the consumer. I mean, there's...
No, I'm saying that this is happening because the government got out of the business of regulating.
Well, yeah, the government is unbelievably involved here. But so we talked about...
How?
Let's talk about in the way there's a bunch of ways, but one way I'll talk about now is similar to the way that the banks have an implicit bailout. Consumers in an economy have not, because there are so many regulations that are supposed to protect us, have this mentality that, well, nothing really bad can happen. So I don't need to be particularly diligent with regard to something, and I can just follow the crowd. So if everyone is investing in, you know, everyone is buying homes, people say, oh, you know.
But what's wrong with that concept, Alex? If somebody is presenting you with a 14-page legal document written in legalese and you didn't go to law school, you can't reasonably be expected to read that thing and know that on the fourth page, on the ninth paragraph, the word or really should have been the word and if it was meant to protect you, but it's going to screw you?
As a consumer, you can certainly, I can certainly understand what an interest rate is. I can understand what an adjusting interest rate is.
But those things are not explicitly disclosed unless the government forces it, and you're against the government forcing it.
No, that is not true. If you cannot charge someone an interest rate as part of a contract if that interest rate is not in a contract. So it's the consumer's responsibility, and morally it is the lender's obligation to know what exactly they're committing to. And many people
morally?
Did
wait a minute. The marketplace is not moral. The marketplace is about profit.
Well, I believe that those two are not incompatible because long-term, look, the interests of lenders and the interests of borrowers are compatible. The lenders want the borrowers to pay off the loans.
They don't. Actually, the vast majority of these lenders right now are companies. They're pump and dump shops. They're companies that are selling the mortgages. They're giving the money to the lender. And then they're taking that mortgage and they're reselling it.
Right. No, I understand.
Since they have no interest in whether it's paid back or not, they can give a hoot. They just want their $20,000 commission. Thank you very much.
So there certainly can be potential conflicts of interest. But if you notice, who is getting hosed there? Well, primarily the investors are getting hosed there. So it's their responsibility to set up the situation in such a way that the intermediaries have their interests geared toward the lender's interest. And what you see right now is a lot of these people who, quote, pump and dump, they are out of the marketplace. They're discredited. Now, the lenders should have exercised, the ultimate lenders, the banks, should have exercised more due diligence. There's nothing.
Yeah, as I said, I'm not disagreeing with you on that, because they can afford the lawyers. But the average guy is not a lawyer and can't read a mortgage document. I mean, some of these documents are so arcane, and particularly with these credit card things. Now credit card companies will have you sign a document that looks quite reasonable. And somewhere buried in that document, it says subjects may change with 90 days notification or whatever. You get a letter in the mail 2 days later that says, this is your 90-day notification that from now on we're jacking your credit rate up to your interest rate up to 27%, and there's nothing you can do about it, Charlie.
You can use a different credit card.
Well, what we have is an industry that is essentially operating as a monopoly. I mean, you've got how many credit card companies? Four big ones? Okay. They're all doing the same thing.
Then don't use credit cards. They're offering you a service that you can either choose to use or not.
What we need is the Sherman Antitrust Act to break these companies. If you believe in competition, you've got to believe in anti-monopoly legislation.
No, if I believe in freedom of competition, which means the freedom to succeed in the marketplace.
Which means the freedom to become a monopoly. Have you ever played the game?
What's that? Yes.
You ever played the game?
I have played the game.
What's the object of the game of monopoly?
To get a lot of money.
To end up owning everything and put everybody else out of business, right?
Right. I don't consider that a sufficient proof against the mountain of evidence that shows that antitrust is destructive of freedom of competition and that actually under laissez-faire what you get is the rewarding of...
Then why did we have so many successful small businesses back before Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and now it's just a few huge large corporations and there's very few small businesses?
Unlike you, I don't consider the existence of corporations necessarily a blight on the country. A lot of corporations are really great and do terrific things.
I'm not talking about corporations. I'm talking about corporate monopolies.
Yeah, as long as there's no coercion involved, they should be able to earn as much market share as they can.
Okay, you can read all about it over at ayanrand.org. Alex Epstein, always good talking with you, Alex.
Right,
thanks for dropping by. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Have you ever got a note from your bank saying,
greetings, your account just shrank by 25 or 30 bucks. Sorry, friend, you're out of luck. You bounced a check. That's what it was. It happens to the best of us. Please cover it quick.
And when you do, you find you got another one or two.
Cause what they done, never seen it fail. They notified you by the U.S. mail. Cost them almost 40 cents, but more than worth that little expense. Cause by the time you receive that letter, their situation got even better. Your first overdraft cost a couple more. Now you owe them a pile of money for sure.
They hope you never wonder in your little head why they don't send you an email instead. A quicker way and cheaper, too, for them as well as the customer, you.
Or an automated call to your phone or pager would be an improvement, vastly major, but they'd lose all those overdraft fees. They charge you a profit center, very large. See, that's what they call it. The banks charge you two or three times and then say,
thanks for making us rich at your expense. Thank God you haven't got the sense to ask us, please, won't you install the software that'll place a call or send an email to let you.
Because, friends, that's how we make our dough.
There you go. See, ultimately, thank you, bankers. Ultimately, and Jim Tur, ultimately, the question is, how do you deal with predators in a society? I mean, this is where the two polar extremes, communism on the one end, on the arguably left end, and absolute laissez-faire libertarianism on the right end, both of them have some accuracy about them with regard to small societies. If you have a small community, a tribe, a very small town where literally everybody knows everybody, and everybody is interdependent, then you don't need government regulation. I mean, I could just hear just an example. You know, I lived in a small town in Vermont. I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, 8,900 people. It's the smallest state capital in the United States. Maybe it's 9,800 people. Whatever it is, it was fewer than 10,000, as I recall. And there was a doctor in town who had been kicked out of a couple of other towns. He came into town and he hurt a couple of people. I mean, he did lousy, as I recall, he was doing eye surgery, and he did lousy work. And word spread like wildfire. That guy couldn't get, we ran him out of town on a rail, essentially. You know, they did turn him into the state, and the state came after him. But that was long after everybody in town knew, don't go to that guy. See, it works in a small town. But even you know, a small town of 9 or 10,000 people, he could find people, even after he took advantage of the first person, he could still find a few more people. So how do you deal with predators? Once a community gets beyond a couple hundred people, I mean, the kibbutz in Israel, they're pure communist societies, and they work. They work quite well because everybody knows everybody. It's a small community. But when you get large enough that people can operate anonymously and can behave like predators, that's the point at which we collectively organize ourselves into an institution that we refer to as government, whether it's state or local, county, town, federal, whatever it may be, the various levels of organization. And one of the main reasons that we do that, the main reasons, at least in the United States, in small d democracy, in the minds of the founders of this country, the main reason that we organized ourselves into democracy was to be supportive of each other, that we are a nation of barn builders. It's the equivalent of the community getting together and building the new barn for the guy whose barn burned down or who just moved into town or whatever. And we are a nation of barn builders. If I said barn builders, barn burners, it's because I only had 3 hours sleep. I mean barn builders. And a secondary function of government is to protect us from those who would burn our barns down. And that's why governments are instituted among men and women, to quote the Declaration of Independence, as I recall, to secure the blessings of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Life, in my opinion, has to do with things like health care, the ability to make a decent living, to have and own a home, to have vacation, to raise your kids. Liberty, knowing that George Bush is not listening in on every phone call and conversation you have, that he's not wiretapping the opposition party, that politicians can just like everybody else know that their phone calls have some privacy associated with them, and the pursuit of happiness. You can have hobbies. You can do the things you want. You can have some leisure time. You can have a decent, high quality life. This is the American dream. These are the American ideals. And implicit in all of this is the protection from predation. And so I think when conservatives say there's been so much government regulation that people kind of expect that when they're signing a contract that it's safe for them to sign it. Yeah, we would really like that. We would like to know that we collectively have gotten together through our elected representatives and said, if you're going to present somebody with a contract, you have to tell them what's in that contract in plain English. Remember the plain English laws that were passed, I think, during the Clinton administration? Contract reform? You have to tell them in plain English what's going on. If you're going to be charging them an interest rate, you have to disclose what it is. If it might change under certain conditions, you have to explain to them what that means. Not everybody's a lawyer. This is just reasonable stuff, just thoroughly reasonable stuff, in my opinion. Now, of course, I'm a big government liberal, so I think that government, we the people, should play a role in making sure that the economy doesn't pump and dump, doesn't blow up in bubbles, and then explode into a Republican Great Depression.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmericaRadio.com.
Gonna kick off my shoes and run in bare feet and wear the grass and the dirt and the gravel on me. Going back to the well, gonna visit old friends.
feed my soul. We're the Blacktop Kings.
34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, this afternoon at 2 o'clock Pacific time, we broadcast live daily from 9 to noon Pacific time. That's noon to 3 Eastern time. Today at 2 o'clock Pacific time, I will be at the Willamette store in Salem, Oregon, where they will have all my books on sale 30% off. They say all my books. I don't know. I got 20 books in print. We'll see. Looking forward to it, though. I'll be talking about Cracking the Code, my newest book. And on Friday next week, December 14th, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota, 7 p.m., the University of Minnesota bookstore, Kauffman Memorial Union. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, some great ideas there about how to deal with telemarketers. Go to TomHartman.com and just click live chat. If you'd like to call, our telephone number 866-303-2270. And there's the blog over at AirAmerica.com as well. Kitty in Queens, New York, listening on WWRL. Hey, Kitty, welcome to the program.
Thank you. One way to deal with telemarketers, sports whistle. They rarely call you back if you whistle into the phone.
Oh, really? You just make a loud noise?
A sports whistle, you know, one of those kind they use for referees.
Oh, yeah.
Just blow it into the phone.
Okay.
They don't call you back very much. But on this guy from Ayn Rand and these mortgages, since Ayn Rand doesn't believe that we should educate people, how are the people going to be able to read the mortgages or any other contract?
Yeah, that's right. They're opposed to public education. Well, they do think that, actually, I can't speak for them, but many conservatives do think that, you know, there should be a meritocracy, that the very wealthy people should be able to educate their children, and therefore we'll just have a country by and for the rich.
Yeah, but what do they do when the people, the predators like you're talking about, go out and lie to the people or make contracts that they can't read and have them sign it?
Well, I think that they think that they're rich enough that they can have a lawyer who will get them out of it. I frankly don't know, Kitty, but your points are well made, and you point out the holes in what they're saying. Marge in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Marge.
Hi, Tom. Yes, I just wanted to respond as well. I'm a realtor here in Portland, and, you know, that gentleman that you interviewed, my only familiarity with that company is your interviews, so I'm not that knowledgeable. But, I mean, that's just another example of how out of touch and not based in reality these people are. When you go into that table to sign those documents, and frankly, it's the first time you've ever seen those documents, you're told some things, but lenders are not transparent. Even to me, as a realtor on the other end of the table, I have to so hold my hand with my buyers and try to help them through, and even I don't know half the time what's going on. And that pile of papers is about 3 to 4 inches thick. Seriously, I'm not kidding. And they have to sign each and every page. They have to understand each and every page. And the way that they present it is they say things like, tied to this index, tied to that index, it'll happen in 2 to 3 years. And don't worry, you can always come back in and refinance. Well, what people don't understand is that as what's just happened, the guidelines change, and they think, well, I finance now, I could probably come back in 3 years and do it again. But the guidelines and how and whether or not you can qualify are completely different today than they were 3 years ago, and more than half of those people can't do it, even based on the same information, and nobody understands that, and that is not transparent to the buyer. So blaming them, I mean, they should, I agree, take some responsibility, but blaming them is ridiculous. It's totally not an easy process.
Yeah. I remember the first time I signed a mortgage. I was in my 20s, in my late 20s. It was the first house that we bought. It was 1978, actually. It was 75. And I actually read the mortgage document all the way through. It was only about 4 pages at the time.
Exactly.
And there was a paragraph in there that said, I, you know, Thomas Hartman, hereby voluntarily give up my rights under, and it named 2 amendments to the U.S. Constitution. It was like the 17th and 18th Amendment or something like that. And I remember reading that, and I said to the banker, I said, you're asking me to give up my constitutional rights? And he said, this is boilerplate. It's standard. Everybody signs it. I said, I'm not going to sign that. And I scratched it out. And he said, well, then we won't countersign the mortgage document. So I had to come back the next day, and in the meantime, I called 2 other banks, and they all said, yep, we all do the same, you know, it's like this giant monopoly. We all have the same language. Because I was just like, on a matter of principle, I'm not going to sign away my constitutional rights. And I did. You know, I ultimately signed away my constitutional rights.
Well,
and
you know,
this is just not all that uncommon.
Well, the part of the big picture that the people aren't mentioning is that at the same time you're dangling in front of this poor person who's got children they're trying to educate and they want the American dream, and you're saying, okay, it's a risk, yes, but you have the potential. And here in Portland, the people that did it, and I have to admit, I've done it a few times with buyers myself that probably, as I look back, probably weren't the best choice. That's not the case in most of them.
Yeah.
But you know, they made 30, the average in Portland, and we are unique here, but the average was $30,000 to $40,000 per year in the last 2 years. So those people did gain something. They took a risk, and most of them are going to be okay, but we are a unique market, and so.
In that case, housing values are going up here, you mean?
Exactly. Yeah. And yeah. So they did take a risk. They probably did get a piece of that American dream that they never would have been able to do. But they dangle that in front of you and say, okay, you know, across the country, here's your chance to do something. And what other chance do we have? So you're worrying, okay, it's a risk that I don't really understand, but I'm being told it's okay, and it's a chance to make this money. Well, I mean, who isn't going to, you know, jump at that opportunity?
Right. And frankly, that's a shame, because when we're talking about a home, it shouldn't be thought of as a chance to make
exactly.
money. It should be thought of as, this is the place I'm going to live for the next 5, 10, 30, 50 years, whatever. But anyway, Marge, thanks so much for the call.
Yeah.
Thanks for your kind words. Steve in Bellingham, Washington. Hey, Steve.
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I always enjoy your show. You're a brilliant guy. I always learn a lot from you. However, I also want to tell your listeners that I am myself kind of a historian and a student of government, and everything that you say pretty much ties in, you know, it lines up with my knowledge of the way democracy is supposed to work. So, I mean, you're right on with the things that you're telling people. As far as this libertarian guy, that last caller was great, by the way. I'm a lawyer. I'm not a real estate lawyer, but you're right about this language that is just too complicated for the average person to understand. A lot of lawyers don't even understand the language.
Yeah.
There's been a movement in the last few years to get away from that complicated language, but of course a lot of lawyers like it to be complicated, so that's the problem there. But we're trying to use like less Latin, you know, and more language that people can understand.
Mm-hmm.
There's a famous story, a true story of these lawyers who were trying to come up with a contract, but the parties involved just got sick of it, and they managed to boil down about 50 pages down to about 3 paragraphs.
Yeah.
Another thing too is a lot of lawyers, they're, you know, we're human. A lot of lawyers make mistakes, and
sure.
and you read these things, and it's easy to miss something.
Yeah, well, I'll give you an example that includes both. Back in the early 70s, I was a principal in an herbal tea company, and we signed a contract with a company in New York for exclusive distribution on our product, and if at the end of 6 months they hadn't performed at a certain level, they had to pay us $50,000. And which was a lot of money back in 74.
Sure.
That was my understanding of the contract. That was their understanding of the contract. This was about a 7-page contract. I had my lawyer read the contract. We paid a lawyer to read it. And he said, yep, that's my understanding. 6 months down the road, they had not fulfilled their end of the agreement. I flew out to New York from I was living in Michigan at the time. Flew out to New York, sat down with these guys and said, okay, I'm here to pick up the $50,000. And they laughed, literally laughed at me. And
yeah.
The guy pulled out the contract and flipped over to page 4, and he said, you see that? And he points to the word or in like one of the sentences, buried in one of the sentences. He says, you see that word or right there? And I said, yeah. He says, I'll bet you and your lawyer thought it was an and. We don't owe you anything. Get out of my office.
Well,
and ever yeah. since then, I have operated every business I have run. I have, including this radio show, in every business decision, I have always made my business decisions based on whether or not I trust the people I'm doing business with. I would much rather do business over a handshake. Our contracts with radio stations, for example, say, you know, if you don't like the show, you know, give us 30 days notice and you're out. We're not going to lock somebody down for years and years at a time. It's, you know, I am only as good as my last show. When I owned the ad agency, we are only as good as our last product. That's the bottom line. And I just, you know, as much as possible, try to get away from using contracts and instead use letters of agreement so that we act, because the one good thing that a contract can do is it does clarify for everybody what the issues are. But frankly, it can also obfuscate them. And so, you know, I get your point and well said, and thank you very much. Sandra in Berkeley, California. Hey, Sandra.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Just great. We just have about a minute before we have to take a break.
Okay, well, it's such a complicated issue, but I'm in the loan business. And let me tell you, it's partly the bank saying spend, 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 spend. It's partly people not making as much money. You know, they've been living their middle-class income, taking money out of their house. Right. I told clients of mine years ago, you can't keep doing this. Houses aren't going to keep going up like this. I would refuse to refinance them, and they would go to somebody else and do it, and then lose their houses.
People using their house like an ATM machine is a huge mistake.
My mother grew up in the Depression, and she used to drive me crazy, but my mother held on to every cent. And what happened to people saying on TV or on radio, save your money, save your money? All we hear is spend, 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 spend. And, you know, and I think it's partly the banks and partly the stock market trying to make money out of bundling the loans. And it's partly
us, you know, looking for a quick buck or looking for it's like gambling, saying, okay, I'll buy this house for, you know, $100,000 on the assumption that next year it'll be worth $105,000 or $110,000 and I'll just resell, or maybe it'll be worth $120,000, $130,000 and I'll make some real money. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. 866-303-2270. TomHartman.com for our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for our blog.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Baby, do you understand me now? Sometimes I feel a little mad. Don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
9 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast and streaming all over the planet. Russ Wright is in the studio with us. He is the CEO of Renewable NRG, like the letters, NRG. Every Thursday at this time, we invite on a local advertiser from our many affiliates all around the country and to tell a very brief story about their company and about their success in advertising locally on Progressive Talk Radio, or talk radio in general, I mean, right across the board. And Russ is advertising here on AM 620 KPOJ in Portland. Russ, welcome.
Thanks, Tom.
Russ, tell us about your company, Renewable Energy.
Yeah, we do commercial and residential solar energy systems integrations. We capitalize on business energy tax credits and incentives that have been put in place by the feds and by the Energy Trust here in Oregon that allow us to put commercial systems in place on nonprofits and commercial businesses as well as residentials.
So my understanding of the bottom line of all this, because, you know, from hearing your ads and having actually voiced one of them, is that if I want to solarize my house and I have a small business, which I do, mm-hmm. or if I am a small business, or for that matter, even a big business,
mm-hmm.
between the solar credits and the grants and things that the state is offering, it'll cover 100% of the cost of doing it. I can do it basically for free. And you guys provide you handle all the paperwork, you take care of everything, and you put the solar system on the house.
Absolutely. For commercial systems, you can actually get back over 100% of the system cost and incentives and have it paid for in 4.5 years or less sometimes. And on these home office systems, you can actually be ahead of the game by several $1,000s by the time you file your taxes for the next year.
So you make a profit the first year, and then you've got solar electricity for the next 50.
Absolutely. You're making a great difference on your carbon footprint and saving money on your electricity.
Marvelous. And you've been advertising on KPOJ for how long?
Just a little bit, right about around a month right now.
And how's it going?
It's been going fantastic. We've gotten an enormous number of calls based on the listenership really connecting with the message, mm-hmm. and looking at the energy savings and the environmental benefit.
Have you tried advertising in other mediums?
We actually did some TV advertising that met with you could say slightly less than auspicious results.
Really?
The response on this has just been fantastic. I couldn't have been more pleased. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. Russ Wright, his company is Renewable NRG, like the letters NRGs, and that's their website, Renewable NRG.com. And for people who are in the Portland area, what's the local phone number here, Russ?
It's 503-674-7861, NRG Sun 1.
NRG Sun 1.
Absolutely.
503 in the 503 area. Thank you very much, Russ Wright.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
The CEO of Renewable Energy, and thanks for advertising on KPOJ. And encouraging, if you have a business, small business, large business, whatever it may be, anywhere in the United States, consider advertising on your local advertising. Great way to start. I mean, national advertising is cool too, and I'll tell you, the network is very pleased to take your money. And for many folks, local advertising, whether it's in Los Angeles or in Santa Fe, I mean, you know, whether it's in a small town, relatively small, Grand Rapids or the big town of Detroit, whatever it may be, consider, checking out your local advertising, because you will find that Progressive Talk Radio is an incredibly successful advertising vehicle. Sherry in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Sherry, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
The gentleman that you spoke to earlier about the mortgage rates, I've listened to the talk show hosts about mortgage rates, and I thought, well, I don't have to get involved with that because we have a house. And we've already, we're doing our mortgage and nothing. We have no, adjustable rate or anything, which was fine. I received a bill yesterday from a large department store in the country, and I paid almost the whole bill off. And I only owed $100, and I pay in cash. Mm-hmm. I put it aside for my checks. Okay,
right.
Paid in cash. I look down, and it says I owe $100 final balance. And it says I owe $14.41 in interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I go, what's going on,
Right.
And I look at it again, and I'm thinking, this is wrong. There's something wrong. So I called them this morning, and I said to him, I don't understand what's going on. I said, I only owe you $100, and I've paid almost $2,000. And he goes, well, that's the normal rate. I said 23.5% on $100. He goes, oh, no, it's on the initial amount. And it's...
But you paid it as soon as you got the bill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said, and I said, and I didn't, I went, I always go in with the money.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't mail it. I know it is, I know that they don't have to worry about cashing a check. It's all there. Okay, and I thought, well, oh, $100, how much interest can be? A couple dollars.
Right.
That's it. And he says, oh, no. He said mortgages are rated that way. Large loans are rated that way.
Yeah.
I said, this has never happened before, ever.
No, I mean, you track back to the changes in the bankruptcy law. I mean, there has just been this mania of deregulation that, frankly, goes back to the Carter administration, although it really picked up steam under Reagan, and it is destroying America. Sherry, thank you for the call and for sharing your story with us. Stephen in Michigan, we have about a minute before we got to wrap up this hour, Stephen.
I just wanted to mention two Latin terms that people talk about, caveat emptor, which buyer beware. But there's another Latin term which says venditor.
Emptor.
Emptor. And buy, seller beware.
Uh-huh.
So mm-hmm. I think you ought to explain to the people that it's not just the borrower that has to be aware of what's happening, but the seller also.
Yeah, there you go. Stephen, thank you very much. Larry in Denver, just a few seconds, Larry. Quickly.
Yeah, I just want to say I don't think this mortgage bailout is very fair to people like, educated people like me who are my girlfriend. I'm an engineer. She's a nurse. And we've been saving, trying to get the down payment to get the house. And now we've got all this, it's just contributing to the false economy as well.
Yeah, I at the level of the bailout, bailing out big banks, big mortgage companies, and cities and towns that bought bonds stupidly, I agree. At the level of helping out the little guy who didn't know how to read the mortgage contract or was lied to by their mortgage company, no, I think we should all be there for ourselves. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy.
Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Where smart people get their news.
And welcome back. Well, Dana Perino, she's standing by her man. Yeah, the president was truthful, don't you know? He wasn't lying to all of us. He was just not as accurate as he should have been. Don't you know? I mean, here's the amazing thing. Bush is saying that, first of all, Seymour Hersh is saying that Bush spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert on Monday. Bush is saying that on Wednesday he learned about the NIE. And so Ed Henry from CNN says, how could he brief Olmert on Monday about a report that he found out about on Wednesday? And Dana Perino, I'll check. I mean, it's possible that he knew there was information coming. She's really spinning here. She's really spinning.
When the president was asked about when he learned about Iran's nuclear program being halted, was he being completely candid?
Yes, he was, and I talked to you about that last night. I talked to your colleague this morning, and I'll reiterate it here. If you look at the rest of that sentence, the president was clearly told that there was new information that was coming in, but he wasn't told the details of it.
Oh, and it's got to be so tough to be the public face, the spokesperson, for somebody who is either really stupid, which, frankly, I don't believe, and I don't think anybody else does, or who is willfully lying to the American people. Here you got Scott McClellan, who preceded her two people back, you know, before Tony Snow, basically come out and said, you know, hey, I was lied to by George Bush. And Scott McClellan saying he was lied to by Dick Cheney. This is with regard to the Valerie Plame affair. And, I mean, you remember?
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Yeah, right. So how do you defend somebody who just blankly, blatantly lies like that?
And the president was also told that the intelligence community was going to need to go back and check out to find out if it's true. What I said is that McConnell told the president, if the new information turns out to be true, what we thought we knew for sure is right. Iran does, in fact, have a covert nuclear weapons program, but it may be suspended. He said that there were many streams of information that were coming in. They could potentially be in conflict. They didn't have a lot of confidence in the information yet.
But the president said, quote, he didn't tell me what the information was. But
Ed Henry pinning it down. But the president said, quote, he didn't tell me what the information was, end quote.
You're now saying he was told that Iran may have halted its nuclear weapons program and also that there may be a new assessment, right?
Right, but he didn't get any of the details of what the information was in terms of what the actual raw intelligence was.
He didn't tell me what the information
was. Okay, but I can see where you could see that the president could have been more precise in that language, but the president was...
This is interesting. She's a very visual... I can see where you could see. And we're talking about words that were spoken. Instead of I could hear or I could, you know, or, you know, as a very kinesthetic person would say, you know, I can get where you could, where you would... get or whatever, but she says, I can see where you could
see. Being truthful.
Janet, listen to what he said. He didn't tell me what the information was. He did tell me it was going to take a while to analyze. Was the president told that there was a possibility that Iran's nuclear program could be suspended? That's what you said he was told.
Yes, the president was told that there is new information in the context of raw intelligence, not told the details of what it was, and told that they're going to have to go back and do some more checking on it because they didn't have a high degree of confidence in it, and it could potentially be in conflict.
But he said he didn't know.
I think she's embellishing considerably here.
What the information even was. I can see the details of it. Right. But
okay, about you could, I grant you, he could have been more precise in his language, but if you look at the following sentences of that quote, he says, I have it right here. He says that it would take a while to analyze. And he's referring to it in terms of what the information was. I think that...
But he said he didn't know what the information was.
He didn't know he did not know what the specific details were of the raw intelligence that they had found.
Just clarify one more thing. What day was the president actually briefed on the NIE? Well, Mr. Hadley left the impression that it was last Wednesday.
On the NIE specifically. Yeah, last Wednesday.
Last Wednesday. Okay.
Correct.
But there have been reports that the president briefed Prime Minister Olmert last week, maybe on Monday. Did he brief Prime Minister Olmert? And how could he brief Olmert on Monday about a report that he found out about on Wednesday? Can you clarify?
I will check. I mean, it's possible that he knew that there was information coming.
Poor Dana Perino. You know, I'm sure that she's a nice person. But, man, what a tough job. What a tough job to be representing this administration. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Pete in Salem, Oregon, you had some thoughts on Mitt Romney's talk today.
Yeah, I found it ironic. I don't know if you got to see the whole thing. I didn't.
I've read the transcript of most of it.
Well, he goes into, standard Christian beliefs. You know, Christ said, when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was naked, you clothed me, etc.
Matthew 25.
Uh-huh. And here I'm sitting here thinking, now, the last Republican debate, this man tried to out-hate Giuliani on immigration.
Right.
And at the very same time that these words are coming out, I was watching MSNBC, and on their crawl across the bottom, it said one-third of all Americans, according to a Bloomberg LA Times survey, one-third of all Americans want to cut social services to illegal immigrants, including public schools and emergency room health care.
Right. Which is, you know, yeah. The public schools, I think, would be arguable or debatable, but to cut emergency room health care to anybody, regardless of their status,
just let them bleed.
Is criminal.
Absolutely. And I'm sitting here, and all of this is going on, and literally almost at the same moment this crawl comes across the bottom, and I'm sitting there, how does this guy square all this?
Mm-hmm.
How does he square it?
Yeah. Apparently he doesn't, and that's and maybe the old Mitt, you know, the old liberal Mitt did. Actually, his name is Willard. We should call him Willard because that's his real name.
They're going to call Obama Hussein, so why not?
Yeah, exactly. So the old Willard Mitt Romney used to get it. The new one doesn't. I think that there's a high degree of pandering going on here, but I didn't see, you know, in the transcript that I read, I saw no defense specifically of Mormonism. If you watched the entire speech, Pete, did he get into the Book of Mormon?
No, he did not.
I expect that he would not. I think that would be suicide on his part with the evangelicals. Pete, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Julie in Sacramento. Hey, Julie.
Hi, Tom. It's such a pleasure to be able to get you on my radio out of San Francisco.
Well, thank you. What's up?
I just wanted to find out, I don't remember the timeline when Valerie Plame was outed. Mm-hmm. Could it be possible that she was outed because of her report that would be coming in that Iran did not have the...
Right, that would have become part of the NIE. It's entirely possible, Julie. Thank you very much for sharing that. Ellen in Manhattan. Hey, Ellen.
Hi, Tom. I watched the Mitt Romney speech and was impressed with the politics of it. But at one point he said that he would never give in to people who were trying to secularize America. And then he made it very clear that he was in favor of other denominations, but he was definitely, his idea of America and American freedom did not include atheists or agnostics or anybody who did not believe in God, did not pray to God, or was not a member of one of these denominations.
Right.
That is really scary. And I was watching this on MSNBC with Chris Matthews and Pat Buchanan and Sally Quinn and David Kuo, who used to run that faith-based office in the White House. And Sally Quinn was the only one who picked up on that. And Chris Matthews absolutely dismissed it. It wasn't an important thing in his estimation
speech. Here's the quote. He says, "We separate church and state in this country for good reason. No religion should dictate to the state, nor should the state interfere with the free practice of religion. But in recent years, the notion of the separation of church and state has been taken by some well beyond its original meaning. They seek to remove from the public domain any acknowledgement of God. Religion is seen as merely a private affair with no place in public life. It is as if they are intent on establishing a new religion in America, the religion of secularism. They are wrong." I'm sorry. This is a secular country. We were not founded as a theocracy. We were not founded as a religion. He goes on to say, "The founders prescribed the establishment of a state religion, but they did not countenance the elimination of religion from the public square. We are one nation under God, and in God we do indeed trust." That was added to our coins in the 1950s as a statement against communism. This is incredible. Ellen, thank you for the call and for pointing this out. He goes on to say, "We should acknowledge the Creator as did our founders." I'm sorry, many of our founders were Unitarians or were deists. They did not acknowledge the Creator that Mitt Romney is talking to. This... mean, this is spooky. All these Republicans trying to out-Christianize each other. 16 minutes past the hour.
Talk radio for the rest of us. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Just a reminder, this afternoon, 2 o'clock, I'll be at the Willamette Store, 900 State Street in Salem, Oregon, doing a riff on cracking the code and signing a whole bunch of my different books. In fact, they're having a one-day sale on Tom Hartman books, 30% off. And in Minneapolis, Minnesota, next Friday, the 14th of December, at 7 p.m., I'll be at the University of Minnesota Bookstore at Kauffman Memorial Union. Again, giving a more or less an hour talk on cracking the code, on the contents of the book, the art and science of political communication, and signing books and things. So check it out. Be there or be square. Mark Carlin on the line with us from BuzzFlash.com. It's Thursdays. On Thursdays, we check in with the folks who are out there in the internets, the tubes, not the trucks, and find out what's being discussed. Hey, Mark, welcome to the program.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. How are you?
Just great. Great to have you with us. BuzzFlash.com, one of my favorite sites, and a tremendously useful site. What do you see, Mark, as the biggest stories of the day?
Well, certainly, at least on your side, still the follow-up to the NIE, and I'm sure you've discussed that quite a bit on your program. Our addition to the debate on that and the discussion is our headline story this morning, which is that Haaretz, an authoritative Israeli paper, revealed that the defense ministry in Israel knew more than a month ago about the findings, yet Bush on Monday said he just learned last week. That would put Bush in an unusual position in the Israeli defense ministry, knowing several weeks before he did that Iran had stopped its nuclear efforts to build a bomb in 2003.
Is this going to fan the flames of the conspiracy folks who say, oh, yeah, well, the Israelis have totally interpenetrated our intelligence service and they've figured it out? Or is this, is that even any kind of a logical explanation, or is it more of the, Bush knew and he lied to us about when he knew?
Well, clearly Bush lied. Last night, the White House, as I'm sure you've probably discussed, Dana Perino said that Bush was informed that there would be new findings and that there was probably a reversal in the Iranian program to develop nuclear weapons. She left it kind of vague, but it went much further than his original denial that he knew about it.
Yeah. I'd like to know what the intelligence services of France and England had to say, too, because, or for that matter, Russia and China, because, this is in the Security Council, and they're the ones who now, as a result of the public release of the NIE, have backed down on even on the sanctions.
Well, clearly you and I know, and anyone who has followed this administration, that these findings were probably out there for some time, and I think you've mentioned that they were probably at least out there a year before the election of 2006. And it's a good question as to why they suddenly, mysteriously just popped up on a Monday after the head of Homeland Security had said that they would never be released, and suddenly on a Monday afternoon they just pop up. I mean, it's a rather startling development.
Well, this is why I got John Bolton on the show yesterday and said, what do you think is going on? Because he didn't use it was my language, not his, but he did not disagree with me. I said, is there a coup going on here? Is there a revolt in the intelligence community and the military? And he said there are people I'm paraphrasing now, but you can go back and listen to the audio. He said there are people in the intelligence community who are promoting things for their own political purposes that are not consonant with the administration's perspective. And I'm like, wait a minute, they work for the administration. And it's just bizarre. It's the conspiracy theorists on the right, the ones who saw a conspiracy in Iran, in Iraq when there was none, and now see a conspiracy in Iran when there is none, are now seeing a conspiracy within the State Department and the Pentagon.
And remember, and the mainstream press is getting the story all muddled up because, of course, the Bush spin after the Iraq war was that the intelligence community had gotten it wrong. So now the mainstream press is saying, well, see, now the intelligence community is they're kind of going along with the Bolton spin, is overcompensating because they got the intelligence wrong before Iraq. But the intelligence wasn't wrong. It was that Cheney had sat on the CIA and Rumsfeld sat on the Defense Department to come up with the intelligence findings that they wanted to justify the war with Iraq. Right. But the mainstream media has forgotten that. And we point out in our morning editor's blog that this is exactly what happened in Iraq. And so I think if there is a revolt in the intelligence community, it's a revolt to stand up for what they're supposed to actually do, which is analyze what they are able to find in terms of intelligence and present those findings. John Bolton is simply upset because the intelligence community, as far as he is concerned, isn't on board with the administration neocon policy to assert a muscular American policy that will dominate the Middle East and basically neo-colonialize it.
Right, and in fact, that's the phrase he used. He said they're opposed to a strong policy with regard to Iran, and which I think, you know, I think is code for threats of violence and the use of violence. But in any case, Mark Carlin, BuzzFlash.com, the website, a pile of great information over there. Mark, thanks for dropping in.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. Christy Harvey up next with the Center for American Progress. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Well, maybe I'm crazy. Maybe it's no big deal. It's just my opinion. It's just how I feel. I dream of a world that's not all the same, where freedom is more than a word that we say, where you can say what you think and no one would dare put you down. I dream of a world that's a two-paper town.
Oh, what a novel idea. A two-paper town. 34 minutes past the hour. 866-303-2270. Judy in Orange County has an interesting take on this, this whole intel leak. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. You know, I was wondering, and this is just a thought on my part, that the leak of from our intelligence agency has anything to do with the China forbidding our naval to land in Hong Kong, and they were behind the scenes kind of pressing, and it just seems kind of funny that all of a sudden this story comes out about bombs and making bombs in Iran, and it was just coincidence, right, to me. Or is, do you think there's something behind it like that?
You know, I frankly doubt it. I suspect that you know, oddly enough, that John Bolton is right, that this has to do with internal politics within the intelligence community and the military, that they're pushing back against the Bushes and Boltons and Cheneys of the world, who are gung-ho to go to war, or at least to get tough with Iran. And I think that if you want to see something, you know, China behaving towards us, their pushback to us for Bush honoring the Dalai Lama, frankly, I think, was when they didn't let the aircraft carrier come in so that the people could participate in the Thanksgiving celebration with their families. I mean, people from all over the country flew to Hong Kong to meet their seamen and soldier relatives in Hong Kong for Thanksgiving, and then the Chinese wouldn't let the ships into the harbor. And then when they finally said yes, the ship was too far away to come back in time to have those meetings. And it was just their way of thumbing their nose at us, I think. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, and the author of the editor of the daily news prep site, MikeCheckRadio.org, is on the line with us. Hey, Christy.
Hey, how are you, Tom?
Just great, but I'll get better. I'm always glad to have you with us. So lots of news. I'm you know, looking at the Think Progress blog and you know, Dana Perino defending Bush. I think one of the biggies, though, is this thing with Arlen Specter. You know, Arlen Specter, every now and then you say, this is a good guy. You know, he really believes in the Constitution because he talks a great line. But then when it comes to actually acting, he always seems to fall back on the Bush side. He's telling Pat Leahy, no, you cannot. He's postponed this vote. You cannot charge Josh Bolton and Karl Rove with contempt. What's the deal?
I don't really understand where this is coming from, and I have to frankly say that I was very surprised when this happened, because they've been talking about these contempt charges forever. And we thought that the real holdup was whether or not Leahy would actually come through and actually charge these guys. And, of course, this all ties into the whole mess with the U.S. attorneys who were fired for political reasons. And then the White House, you know, hid the emails and then wouldn't let their people testify, then said, well, they can testify, but only if it's in secret, there's no transcript, and no one ever learns what they said.
Doesn't this also have something to do with the violations of the Hatch Act of Karl Rove doing song and dances for government employees about how to help Republican candidates?
It does.
Or the Smith Act? The Hatch Act. I forget which act.
I think it's the Hatch Act, exactly. And, so they were very, you know, we were waiting for Patrick Leahy to come forward, and yesterday the big news was that he was going to move on issuing these contempt charges today. And then Arlen Specter stepped in and postponed it. And we're not quite sure why, because he's been out in front also on this matter and really tried to hammer it home. So, Arlen, we don't know what you're doing over there, love, but it's not a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. Similarly, in another category of it ain't a good thing, the Wall Street Journal going after Al Gore. What's the deal here?
This is pretty crazy, I thought. There is a writer for the right-wing Wall Street Journal opinion pages who actually makes them look lefty and sort of pink.
You're talking about Holman Jenkins?
Holman Jenkins. And he's just sort of one of those nasty sort of dweeby guys, and I do read him because he's usually so outrageous and makes no sense, and it just sort of makes you roll your eyes. But yesterday he went a little far even for me, and he's always on the anti-global warming path, and he just has the most bizarre rationales, like, well, scientists can't really prove anything, so you can't really trust scientists on any sort of theories. And you're like, okay, Holman, that's not really doing it for me.
Therefore, never take any pharmaceuticals, never use plastics, never drive in a car. After all, engineers put that thing together. Never live in a home. Maybe you should just get some bear skins and live by the river.
Well, exactly. And in the same breath, he'll talk about how important it is to follow, you know, Bush's economic theory of cutting taxes for the rich to make everybody else happy, you know, and so... He's just sort of wacky. So yesterday, he came out with this hatchet job against Al Gore. And it was just nasty. And reading it, you could just hear the bile and the vitriol that he was just spitting all over the paper. And he said something, he was making fun of Al Gore for winning the prize and said, you know, he hoped it would help him with his higher calling of being savior of the planet. And I couldn't figure out what his goal really was. So I went back and was reading some of Holman Jenkins' older pieces he had done, and he did a piece 2 years ago, at the beginning of 2006, in which he talked about the only way that you could really attack global warming supporters was to go after the credibility of their lead supporters.
Kill the messenger.
Exactly. And if you went out and did a character assassination on people like Bill Clinton and Al Gore, that was the only way you could really influence people into not believing about global warming.
Which is really an admission of failure on the part of their scientific argument to the.
Oh, absolutely, and it was just sort of, well, now you see through his ruse, and once you realize what he's doing, then the article just becomes pathetic as opposed to as mean-spirited as it was before. But yeah, it was just really, really nasty. Yeah. And my favorite line of his, though, was that near the end of his article, he said, well, we shouldn't even worry about climate change because no matter what happens, at the end of the day, there'll probably be some technology down the road that will be able to stabilize climate.
Yeah. You know, in March, we'll be starting the sixth year of this program. And one of the things that I always have focused on in this program very heavily is economics. And the Wall Street Journal has actually been historically, for me, a very, very good resource in as much as their reporting has always been very solid. Their editorial page is off the wall, but their reporting has always been very solid. But I've noticed in the last few months, particularly since Rupert Murdoch has been positioned to take this thing over, I don't think he has yet completely taken it over, but that it's just fallen into the toilet. And I read the Financial Times every day now. I'll glance through the Wall Street Journal, but I anticipate within the next few months that I'm just going to cancel my subscription to the Wall Street Journal.
I'm with you, and it's really sad. I don't know if you know this. I used to work at the Wall Street Journal.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was a researcher there for about 6 years. And it is really sad and really telling because I had a lot of friends, of course, who were still there and reporting, and they had a crack political team and a good economic team, and people sometimes confused that, I think, with the crazy op-ed team.
Yeah.
But since Rupert Murdoch's taken over, all of the really good reporters are saying, we're not sticking around for this.
Yeah.
And they're moving to places like The Post and The Times and Politico and starting blogs and doing other things because they know that once that happens, it's over.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I'm discovering that the Financial Times, I think that they see this opportunity because they're starting to aggressively market themselves, and their American version, their American edition, is just nowadays, in my opinion, so much better than the Wall Street Journal. And I, you know, for years, I mean, I recommended to my listeners, I said, I'm a liberal, you're liberals, we should read the Wall Street Journal. Read what the rich say when they're talking to the rich. Read what the business, big corporations say when they're talking to the CEOs of other big corporations. Because, you know, the Wall Street Journal, outside of the editorial page, plays it right straight down the middle. They did generally tell the truth about that. I mean, they were the ones who outed Bill McGuire making $1.78 billion as the CEO of the second largest healthcare insurance company in the country. They were the ones who did the five-part series on the rationing of healthcare in the United States. The Wall Street Journal has done some really groundbreaking reporting, and it's gone. I feel like I'm in mourning. But
it's
anyhow,
the same. It's so
moving
sad.
Along. Homeland Security is for sale. Say what?
Yeah, there's some. It turns out that a lot of the money that we've been spending on Homeland Security is going to, ta-da, of course, you guessed it, Bush cronies. And we're not getting anything in return. And the Center for Responsibility in Ethics in Washington, CREW, they're so great.
Mm-hmm.
And they sat down and they were like, okay, we're spending billions of dollars on quote-unquote Homeland Security. Where is it actually going? And, for example, we spent $1.3 billion on a U.S. visit program that was supposed to work on border security, and it was never implemented. They built it, didn't really work, wasn't really ever going to do anything. And so it's gone.
But some contractor made off with $1.3 million.
Exactly.
$1.3 billion.
We spent $2 billion on the virtual fence, which was going to put all these high-tech cameras along the border, but it turned out that they couldn't get rained on because then they broke. And so it's a lot of sort of the waste and the fraud that we've seen.
You know, in Vanity Fair, the current issue of Vanity Fair, there's an article about one of the defense contractors, and they point out that the amount of money that the federal government is now giving to private contractors is equal to all the taxes paid by everybody in the United States who makes $100,000 a year or less.
Wow.
It's mind-boggling.
Yeah.
Christy Harvey, Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Thanks, Christy.
Thank you.
Great talking to you.
As I walked out tonight in the mystic garden, the wounded flowers were dangling from the vine. I was passing by a young cool crystal fountain. Someone hit me from behind. Ain't talking, just walking through this weary world of the world. Hot burning, still yearning. No one on earth would ever know.
Welcome back. 9 and a half minutes before the hours. The hours. You can tell what happens when I'm running on 3 hours of sleep. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I know you've been talking about Dana Perino and what was going on at the briefing today.
Trying to make sense of it. I'm baffled. You know, is she in the terrible position that Scott McClellan found himself in of being lied to, or is she lying on behalf of the liar, or is there some deep subtlety here that we're all missing?
I don't know that we're missing anything, but as you know, the press really went after it. It got very, very heated in the press room today, and I can't tell you what really happened, and I don't think we're going to know. At least not in the near future. We may know 2 years from now, but I don't think we're going to know now.
Whether Bush lied about when and what and all that kind of
exactly.
thing. And you think the press is just going to let go of it?
Well, I don't know that the president's going to. Do I think the press is going to let go
right.
of it?
Right.
I think the press will write about it as much as they can, and I think probably the White House strategy will be to let them write as much as they can. And then the question is whether Congress picks it up at all. And that's really the issue.
Yeah, that would be the place to investigate it, because Congress has a subpoena power.
They have the power. I mean, what does the press do? They can write stories, and the White House can simply decide not to answer it. I mean, Reid did say, he said he was growing concerned about the White House's inconsistent explanations when the president was told how important this it was. And then he said it appears the president and vice president were briefed in August on this information. And he said he urges the White House to fully and accurately explain. But the question is, will they make that have any teeth, or will they let it just sort of sit there in the press and fulminate?
Well, if this is the Republicans, they'd have a $72 million investigation complete with Ken Starr. I mean, what committee would this logically fall to?
Well, I think it could actually fall to several. Obviously, whoever does intelligence oversight, it could definitely go to that. That's my guess is where it would go, because they have oversight and they sort of have a right to pull in the national intelligence. They don't have a right to pull in the vice president and the president, as you know. But I think it would probably go to the intelligence committee.
Interesting. And who's chairman of that committee right now?
Is it Pat Leahy, or is that Florence?
No, it's Jay. Is it Jay Rockefeller? No.
Oh gosh, you know what?
Yeah.
Let me just get my little.
We'll both have to look.
I
it
have
up.
My little congressional book here, and I'll look it up.
Okay, and while you're doing that, you can tell us what else
okay.
is going on in Washington D.C.
The other things that are going on is that there is a lot going on in terms of this mortgage issue, and as you know, President Bush today talked about this mortgage foreclosure that he wants to do. I think he's calling it Hope Now on the subprime issue, but it's not necessarily going to get very far, because it is only going to take care of about 10 or 11% of the people. Meanwhile, there has been the Mortgage Bankers Association said today that home mortgage foreclosures hit another all-time high in the third quarter, increasing to 0.78% up from 0.65%. And at the same time, what's going on is that the people in Congress, and particularly the Senate, have been very, very concerned about this. And one of the things that they are very concerned about is food. It is interesting in terms of food that today Sherrod Brown said that he is putting together a major bill that will increase food aid, and that he said that in Ohio in particular, food reserves that were intended to last until July are projected to run out by February, that food banks are now forced to ration and turn families away.
In the United States of America.
Is that unbelievable?
Well, you know, post-Reagan, no, it's not, but it's tragic. It's truly tragic. I mean, this is the direction that Reagan took us in, is the nation of rugged individualists, to hell with the idea of a nation, you know, of community, of we're here for each other. And his famous...
I've always felt the 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
And so apparently the government isn't helping anymore.
Rockefeller, by the way, is the Select Committee on Intelligence.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Pat Robertson was before it flipped.
And it's Feinstein, Wyden, by Mikulski, Feingold, Nelson, and Whitehouse
Yeah,
on the Democratic side.
So it'll be interesting to see if Jay Rockefeller does anything with this.
It certainly will be. But, you know, I have a feeling that there are people such as Feingold who will be very, very upset about this.
And oh, yeah. Russ Feingold would be the guy. He's just not the chairman of the committee, so all he can do is fulminate, you know.
In terms of the White House, the energy bill, they are saying that they are going to veto it if it comes in the form that it is today. Nancy Pelosi said today, well, they've addressed most of the concerns that the White House has presented to them, and that a renewable electricity standard passed the House with a 30-vote majority, strong bipartisan support, and so I think that she is saying, hey, we're just going to put it before him, let him see if he's going to veto it.
Yeah. Do you think that it'll get veto-proof passage? We had Jay Inslee on about this earlier. Veto-proof passage.
Yeah, I talked to Inslee also. I think that there's so much money on the Hill from the energy companies, I just don't see it happening.
Because they want it to be vetoed. They don't want this thing to pass.
That's right.
Because it's cutting out the billions of dollars of subsidies for the big oil.
You got it.
And the big coal. Okay, Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Coming up tomorrow, Senator Bernie Sanders, Brunch with Bernie, taking your calls, and Larissa Alexandrovna is going to tell us about the political prisoner, the Democrat political prisoner here in the United States. And I'll be at the Willamette Store in 2 hours in Salem, Oregon. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.